This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're battling addiction to heroin or other opioids, one option you might turn to is kratom. It's an opiate-like herb that helps with withdrawal symptoms, but without becoming addictive itself. There are people who swear it saved them from even alcoholism. But it's not well studied and narrowly escaped a temporary ban from the DEA this fall. What's next? Well, here with the scoop on that and other short subjects in science is Nick Stockton, science reporter over at Wired. He joins us from San Francisco. Welcome.
Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Nice. So what is next for... It's pronounced a couple of different ways, isn't it? Kratom or Kratin or Kratom or whatever.
Yeah, so I think most of the people I spoke to who use it call it Kratom.
Okay.
So the public comment period, the extended public comment period, just ended on December 1st. And so now the DEA has over 10,000 comments to sift through before they make their next decision about whether to put it as an emergency Schedule 1 or to schedule it at all.
And so who's speaking in favor of it?
Many people. A lot of them, you know, these are people in their mid to late 30s and older, people who got hooked on opioids. It's not like the party drug demographic, really. These are a lot of people who are saying it helps them, as you mentioned, with their opioid addiction or heroin addiction or managing pain, things like that. But they also, I spoke to quite a few of them, and all of them say, like, they want it studied. They want to know. They're former addicts, and they don't want to become addicted to something else or become dependent on. They want to know that it's not addictive, and they want to know that it is actually doing the things that they think it's doing.
Do we know how safe it is?
Also hasn't been research on that, but there's only been 15 cases of people getting taken in with kratom overdoses. But in 14 of those cases, people had other stuff in their system because, again, people are using kratom to treat, you know, coming down from other opioids. So those overdoses could have been likely caused by those other things as well.
Is it possible it's being released too soon before we know what these side effects might be?
You mean the scheduling?
Yeah.
It is possible. The DEA kind of has a history of being very precautionary about which drugs it schedules and trying to stay ahead. You know, it is doing diligence. You know, things like synthetic marijuana, which are very dangerous, and it's, you know, adding those to schedule, you know, very rapidly. And so this seems to be another instance of the DEA kind of just trying to be very precautionary. But the fact that they stepped back and put a pause on the emergency schedule that they had announced earlier in the summer is kind of shows a little progression in the DEA's policies.
Mm. Let's move on to another story I saw, very interesting. There's more crude oil leaking into the ocean than we were aware of.
Right. Yeah. So this is a story that my colleague Emma Gray Ellis found earlier this summer, and she's been working on it for quite a while. She was just looking at this somewhat small leak that it only leaks about 84 to 1,000 or 1,500 gallons a day, which is relatively small, but it's going to keep leaking for another 100 years. And because it goes under this threshold of 100,000 gallons, that it doesn't meet this requirements for like extra cleanup and extra money and extra penalties for the oil company that dropped it or that caused the spill. And there's over 30,000 of these a year that happen. And so cumulatively, the accounting isn't super clear, but cumulatively they possibly add up to as much of an Exxon Valdez size of oil leaking into U.S. waters each year.
I saw the article in Wired. It's just amazing how much of this oil is still just seeping out of different spots.
It's baffling. Yeah.
You attended the latest round of the Breakthrough Prizes, kind of a celebrity-studded event, huh? A lot of celebs there.
Yes, it was very fun. The Breakthroughs they're about 5 years old, and there's this prize founded by several Silicon Valley billionaires, people like Mark Zuckerberg and Anne Wojcicki, and they award achievements in life science, fundamental physics, mathematics, and if that sounds like the Nobels, then you're right. They have a lot of Nobel overlap. The things that make them different are they have a ton of celebrities there. You know, people like Alex Rodriguez, Vin Diesel, Jeremy Irons, Will.i.am, Alicia Keys. And then plus, you know, tech people like Zuckerberg and Wojcicki, who are pretty big celebs in their own right, at least, you know, here in San Francisco area. And the other cool thing that happens at the Breakthroughs, which is what really got me interested, is they don't have these really strict limits that the Nobels have. And so one of the awards was given for the LIGO experiment, and they actually dispersed the money, two-thirds of the money, which was $3 million given to the LIGO team, to the over 1,000 people who worked on it, rather than just the top three, you know, principal investigators on this.
Wow, so it's big money. It's not just, you know, like the Ig Nobel smackies. It's real. They're trying to be serious with big money.
Yeah, they're definitely trying to, you know, push forward research, and they're very interested in, like, philanthropic giving towards science, especially with some of the threats towards science funding that, yeah, you know, have been happening for years now and are maybe a little more real in years to come.
You betcha. Lastly, someone proved Richard Feynman wrong about something?
I know. It's crazy. Several decades ago, Richard Feynman, you know, threw out in one of his talks that the Earth's core is several hours to days older than the crust. And this is, of course, due to the things we know about how gravity warps time, thanks to Albert Einstein's work on relativity. And so things with high gravity move faster relative places with low gravity. And so these scientists, you know, Richard Feynman said this in, you know, several decades ago in a talk, and then there was a paper that came out of it, and they put it at a couple of days. But nobody really checked the math, and until, you know, these two Danish researchers went ahead and started, you know, jotting it down and looking at the equations, and they put it at, actually, it's 2.5 years, you know, since the Earth's formation, that, you know, that's how much older the core is to the crust.
Two and a half years. And Feynman just off the top of his head said a couple of days, and then when you really look at it, it's 2.5 years.
Right.
Because gravity is stronger at the core, so time slows down.
Time speeds up.
Speeds up.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And so this just kind of shows the value. Like, the point of science is to find truth. So even, you know, you got to check your heroes even.
Wow. So, you know what that means, that someone is going to take it on a third time and see if they can disprove the second person.
Exactly. Well, I mean, these authors, they tell physics students, check the math. Do these calculations in class.
Wow. Okay. I'm going to do that myself when I get off the air. Look, I love Richard Feynman stuff. It's great. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah.
Nick Stockton.
You're welcome, Larry.
You're welcome. Nick Stockton is a science reporter over at Wired, and he was joining us from San Francisco. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, earlier this year, there was an uproar over the price of EpiPens. The price tag for two doses of the injection shot up to $600. In 2007, that would have cost just $94, a pretty hefty price for a life-saving drug. But there are copay drug coupons that can knock off about $300 from that big price of $600. So who doesn't love a discount? These drug coupons can help with prices up front to make certain drugs more affordable, but they do come with a few hidden costs. And then my next guest is here to take us through the good and the bad of these drug coupons. Margo Sanger-Katz is a health correspondent for the New York Times based out of Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me.
So these are the coupons you get from your doctor, or you can find them online and you take it to the pharmacy and they give you a discount.
Exactly. So, you know, generally when you buy a drug at the drugstore, you have to pay some amount that your insurance requires you to pay, and these can knock that down so you can get the drug for free or close to free.
Free or close to free. So that's the good thing, right?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, if you're an individual person and you're buying a drug, especially one that your insurance company wants to charge you a high copayment for, it can really affect the price of the drug. It might make a drug more affordable that would have been out of reach before.
Mm-hmm. So how do the insurance companies use copays to balance out drug costs?
Yeah, so they use it for two reasons. One is sort of obvious, which is to steer you as the customer. If there's two drugs, a generic drug and a brand name drug, and they're, you know, biologically identical, the insurance company wants you to choose the generic drug because it's cheaper. So what it does is it uses the copayment as sort of a signaling mechanism. If you take this generic drug, it's going to cost you $5. If you want to use the brand name version, you might have to pay $50. And so that is used as a signal to steer you towards the cheaper drug. So that's one thing that the copayment does. But the other thing is sort of behind the scenes, which is your insurance company is constantly negotiating with drug companies to try to get the best price for the brand name drugs that it does have to buy. So imagine a different scenario where there are two similar drugs that are maybe not exactly the same, but they work kind of the same way. And the insurance company is trying to get both of them to knock down their price as much as possible so they can get a bulk discount. And the leverage that the insurance company has is they say, if you give me a good price, the best price on your drug, then I will put it with a low copayment, and all of the people who buy my plan are going to choose your drug instead of your competitors. And the copayment becomes an inducement for the drug company to offer a discount to the insurance company.
So what's the bad news about all of this?
So the bad news is that when these copay coupons go into effect, none of those incentives work anymore. So if you are a person who needs a particular drug, let's say it's a drug where there's a generic version, and you could get a coupon for the brand name, and you go to the drugstore and it's $5 either way, you don't really have a preference anymore, and your insurance company can't steer you towards the cheaper thing. So you may be much more likely to buy the expensive drug. And that ends up driving up the cost of your insurance over time, because the copayment, even though it can be a lot for individual people, generally the copayment is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. You know, many of these drugs may cost your insurance company hundreds or thousands of dollars. So for you, you're thinking about the difference between $5 and $50, but your insurance company may be thinking about the difference between a $20 total price and a $300 total price. And so that can drive up your premiums over time. But the other bad thing is it really can mess up these negotiations between the drug companies and the insurance companies, because if the insurance company can't effectively steer its patients to the discounted product, if you don't care between these two brand names because of a coupon, then maybe both of those drugs will get no discount and the insurance company will have to pay a high price for both of them.
Well, so you get hit in the long run with insurance premiums. There are bans on these coupons in certain areas, aren't there?
There are. So Medicare, the drug program for people over 65, does not allow them to be used. And there are some states that have bans, including, I think most prominently, Massachusetts doesn't allow them.
Is it working there, the ban?
So researchers recently did a study where they compared people in Massachusetts to people in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire has no ban. And what they looked at just drugs where there's a generic equivalent. And what they found is that people in Massachusetts where there was a ban, many more of them chose the generic drug, and that the savings were actually quite substantial.
Wow. Thank you, Margo. Margo Sanger-Katz is a health correspondent for the New York Times based out of Washington. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with the White House Chief Data Scientist, G.J. Patil. He's here, ready to chat with us all. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Researchers estimate that there are about 4 zettabytes of data in the world. How much is a zettabyte? Well, if a single character of text represents 1 byte, then there are 1,250 pages, you know, that the War and Peace tomb, that would fit into a zettabyte 323 trillion times. Wow, that's a lot of War and Peace. That's some big data. But so what? Data is just something websites collect to try and sell you that perfect electric toothbrush, right? Sure, but it turns out that the world is full of data. You have them in Metro card swipes, police dispatch calls, blood pressure numbers, facial recognition, all of which can be used to solve a number of important issues. And to that end, in 2015, President Obama tapped data scientist D.J. Patil to be the first Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Data Policy at the White House. And over the next 2 years, Patil worked on programs that used big data to solve big issues in areas like criminal justice and health care. But now, as the Obama administration starts to wind down, what legacy will these big data projects leave behind? Were they successful? What's the future looking like for big data in government? Well, D.J. Patil is here to talk with us about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here.
When you were first named back in 2015, what was the vision you had for big data at the White House?
Well, we sat down actually with the president and we came up with a mission statement. And the mission statement is to responsibly unleash the power of data to benefit all Americans. And the big two kind of components of that are responsibly, and that is just because we can doesn't always mean we should. And how do you make sure it benefits all Americans? You know, we have this talk about technology being radical and revolutionary. And our assertion is that a technology is neither radical nor revolutionary unless it benefits every single person.
Mm-hmm. Did people understand what big data was when you came to the White House?
Well, in fact, the president is the one person who has singularly pushed that we have to get ahead of the big data curve. And when he, even before I got there, he had commissioned a report to talk about what is big data, how do we think about it, and what are the implications for society. And out of that, there came two really big components of it. One was, how do we use it in healthcare? And what are the implications that we need to get ready for? We've written a number of White House reports following on that, everything from the intersection of big data and civil rights all the way to most recently, how do we think about artificial intelligence?
Really? Let's talk about civil rights. How did you help craft or use big data in civil rights?
Well, one of the big things that we have been looking at is where should you be thinking about the opportunities for data to help on civil rights, and also where could it be used to impede civil rights? So one of the cases that we don't always think about is in housing. Is data being used to help people get into housing, or is it being used to artificially isolate a certain population? In evictions and using that data as a marker, how do you have recourse to know if that was true, or how does somebody actually fact check your background and credit history? There's also a lot of data that's out there that could show you're credit worthy, but it's just not utilized or it's not tracked.
Really?
Absolutely. So in the case of banking, there's a large portion of the population that just doesn't have a data signature. Mm-hmm. And because they don't have a data signature, they don't actually get credit for this. One of the groups, Capital One, way back, 20, 30 years ago, they were the first ones to start showing that you could actually get credit to middle-class Americans. And they just used different data signatures. On the flip side,
right,
things like in policing, and the president after the Ferguson, all the incidents in Ferguson and the shootings, he commissioned a task force on 21st century policing. A number of the recommendations were all data and technology related. Some good. How do we use body cameras? How do we think about using data in all sorts of different elements? And I can talk more at length about that. But the other is the concerns also. So if somebody's coming up with the idea of predictive policing, well, how do we have the ability to have transparency into how those algorithms are chosen or what data goes into that? So it's not just some artificial justification of stop and frisk.
So the data could be biased. The algorithm could be biased if you're not careful.
Absolutely. In fact, what we're finding is biased data all over the place. And so you have to be constantly asking the questions. And we're seeing this from basic science all the way at the genomic layer of testing, all the way through other types of activities. The one place that is really important to call out is also what we're trying to do is make sure that we're getting this data out there so everyone can evaluate. Just like you were talking about with Feynman,
right,
somebody's able to reproduce the results. Mm-hmm. In our case, we want everyone to reproduce the world. So people often talk, well, the data is just biased in climate. Well, in the climate, like the data is so overwhelmingly clear, and anybody can download the data and look at it and evaluate and ask questions. It's just obvious at this point that climate change is happening.
Yeah.
And so we go through that rigor, and we eliminate that saying, yep, this is a case of this is scientifically rigorous.
Mm-hmm. And what about precision medicine, mm-hmm, big data?
Right. So the idea of precision medicine is how do we really step forward into the genomic era? Right now, precision medicine happens where if you are sick with cancer or some other type of chronic disease, somebody could use your genomic information, all that type of information from a DNA test, to get you tailored treatments. The problem is that's not true for everyone right now.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we create that at large? How do we enable data to happen for everybody? So what has happened through the Precision Medicine Initiative, which the president launched 2 years ago, is the idea that any American could contribute their data, donate it to the National Institutes of Health, and create the world's largest repository of data, not just at the genomic layer of your DNA, but all the other medical information that sits inside the doctor's office to truly understand all the implications of chronic diseases or other things that we just haven't thought about.
Well, but people are going to be worried, hey, if my information is in a big database that anybody can get to, they're going to know all about my private stuff, privacy.
Absolutely. So one of the first, there's a couple tenets that are essential to everything you do when you go into precision medicine. The first, at the most part, is when you're deciding, classically when you do research, you don't have the actual patient or the participant at the table. In this case, the patient participant is there front and center, always at the table. And that is a real dramatic shift because the questions of consent, who has access to the data, what are you doing with the data? It's not just some advocacy group on your behalf, it's the actual, mm-hmm, people.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that is security and privacy. And that's why we've been working very aggressively to release, and we've released the White House guidance and policies around how to think about security and privacy. And those programs and grants have gone out, and they have a very different model. One of the ones that we've been working on very closely with the Secretary of Defense on is this idea of bug bounty program. He announced a program called Hack the Pentagon, which what it does is, which it sounds kind of weird, but it says, hey, let's go out and ask America's best hackers to come beat us up and then tell us about it. And within minutes, you find all the vulnerabilities and then you're able to go fix them. So we're taking those approaches.
Could you have found the vulnerabilities in this last campaign if the Russians had hacked our system? Would big data show that?
Well, I can't get into those comments of what it happens in the elections. But what I can say is for any type of system that we're working on, and this is why the president has another commission on cybersecurity and creation of a nice cybersecurity national action plan, is how do we start thinking about the next generation of security? And this is one of the big things, and this also gets into AI, and what we publish in the AI report is there has to be two important things in any training program that anybody in data is going into. And when I say data, I mean economics, I mean statistics, mathematics, computer science, any type of engineering. You have to have ethics as part of the core training. So you can start to have conversations about, is this okay? Is this acceptable? The second is security. Security can no longer can be an elective for anybody that's training for these things. Because if you're learning about a database or building one of these systems, you have to know how somebody might be getting data out or attacking that system in a way that you hadn't anticipated. All of those things, as they start to come together, give us a different approach to think about what is it going to require to protect systems.
Talking with Vijay Patil, Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Data Policy at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Our number 844-724-8255. If you have a question, if you want to tweet us here at Science Friday. So your job is over January 20th.
Do you know
where you'll be going and what you're going to be doing yet?
I'm going home and I'm going to take a long nap. But in all seriousness, like the problems, the most important thing that I've taken away from this, you know, I tell people is we always focus on the data. It's more important to actually focus on the people, and the data provides a solution to get there. Some of the problems that I'm extremely excited about continuing working on is not only the type of precision medicine and cancer moonshot programs of how do we enable new data sets to ask really phenomenal questions, but is on the policing side. And how do we also address our criminal justice system? Because we have, you know, just to give a sense of numbers for the audience out there, the numbers are crazy. I mean, we have more than 11 million people, roughly 11.4 people going through 3,100 jails every year.
Wow.
And when I say jails, I mean your local jail. They stay there on average 23 days. 95% of them never go on to prison. So we have this cycle that people are just going around and around and around in. Those are incredible dollars. They are going and preventing your local city from paying for a teacher, an officer, a park. So how do you do with it? Well, it turns out cities have figured out that if you take your data from your criminal justice system and say, who are these people you keep cycling, and you write them on a list, you think of it just like on a spreadsheet, and you hand that over to the healthcare system, the hospitals, and they say, have you seen these people? And they can say, yes, we see these people a lot. In Camden, New Jersey, 70% of all the medical costs come from 10% of the population.
Mm.
So when you look at that, now you have the privacy measures because of the healthcare ecosystem, and you can say to dispatch, hey, instead of taking that person to jail, let's get them into the right medical treatment. Let's get them into the right opioid treatment plan. And I know you're going to talk about 21st century cures later.
Yeah.
These are why these dollars for these things are important. Miami-Dade, Florida. They trained all their people up in this idea of intervention, crisis intervention. It cost about $1 million in the first year. But as a result, in the first year alone, they saved more than $10 million. And more importantly, they were able to close a full jail. That's the power when data comes together with public policy.
But how do you get them to talk to one another?
Yeah, well, that's where we come in.
Yeah.
So oftentimes what happens is, and what we did in a lot of these things is literally what we took a bunch of the technologists and the police chiefs and the medical people and the civic activists, and we locked them in a room at the White House and we left a bunch of presidential cupcakes on the table. We said, what could happen? And they said, hey, you know what? We could open up data. We could share data. Even in policing, the police departments, one of the things that we've seen is we have something called the Police Data Initiative, which gets communities to start opening up their data and just putting it on the web so people can ask basic questions. So it says, Town A, your data, your stop rates, your search rates, they look like this. How does it compare to Town B? Those little things, they now cover actually over 95 million Americans. They cover 10 states. They cover 139 jurisdictions. They get a community to form to ask best practices because there's a lot of legacy technology and problems that prevent people from doing any work in those local towns.
You know, I'm sure that very few people have heard about these things until this very second. Why are these the best hidden secrets about big data and how cooperation between different parts of the government?
Well, I think one of the challenges is we're really focused on talking about data around just a few dimensional areas. Obviously, one is fantasy football, and I don't want to take that away from anybody or baseball. But we're also seeing this dimension where we're moving beyond just talking about what can data do for a social networking site. Mm. And we're moving on to saying, what can data do to empower people and do things in a remarkable way? And the biggest change that we're seeing, and this is what I think President Obama has singularly realized in putting science and technology back into its rightful place at the White House, is that when technologists and science policymakers and everyone are at the table, at the beginning, you say, hey, what about if we did this? And it becomes a dramatic force multiplier. What we have to do is we have to help people see the value proposition. And that's why I think it's so great that you're we're talking about it.
Well, somebody should be talking about science on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with DJ Patil. So is your position, and now you're the first person in this position, do we know if it's going to survive the next presidency?
Well, right now the way the transition process works is it's really best to think of it as an analogy as a baton race. So we're sprinting. We need the next the team of President-elect Trump to sprint with us. We've prepared all the material. We've helped them not only see what the decisions we made, but how we got to these decisions. And we're passing that baton to them so they can figure it out. It is every president and president-elect's choice of how they structure the White House. And so the only thing we can comment on is that we'll give them the best option to think about it. And, you know, I think one of the benefits that we see is that data is a force multiplier. Mm-hmm. The part that I tell people, though, is there are in the agencies, the federal agencies, think National Institutes for Health, think Commerce Department, Department of Defense. There are over 40 chief data scientists or chief data officers in those departments now. And so there is a transition that has happened of all these agencies also recognizing, and those are career civil servants, and they will continue to really continue to push the data mission forward.
But before your career as a data scientist, you started out in community college.
That's right. Yeah.
You support the president's community college education initiative, I would imagine.
I am a big advocate, obviously, because of community college. And the reason I am is most people think, oh, you know, we have this vision of ourself of the mathematician who just instantly gets it and, by fifth grade is already doing collegiate work.
MIT material.
Yeah. It was like my father was a professor at MIT, and let me tell you, I'm not. What was it back then?
Me neither.
So I was that kid who barely graduated through high school because of my math grades. But I went to the local community college. I was super fortunate that I had a girlfriend who was in this calculus class. And so I went along to the calculus class and I fell in love with it. And the instructor who was teaching calculus was so good that she helped me understand the value proposition. And more so, I was in class with people who were putting all their energy into earning a dollar so they could go to these classes. And it gave me a different appreciation for why doing that. I was very able to quickly move on from the community college into the traditional academic sectors. But the thing that's always stuck with me is, imagine as we talk about all these programs, there's somebody out there that wants to take one of these classes. How do we know? Because all these massive online courses are out there. But there's something else that you need when you're working on hard problems around data or mathematics or science. You need a community. You need a group to work with. And there's some of that on the online forum. But if we had that power and everyone had the opportunity to get a little bit more education, we would massively transform this country.
Yeah, and that's what we need for new jobs. Thank you, DJ.
My pleasure. Thank you.
DJ Patil, U.S. Chief Data Scientist at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Good luck to wherever you're going.
Thank you.
Check back in with us.
I'd love to.
When you land on your feet again, which I'm sure you will. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we are going to change direction, and I've got to see what we're going to talk about. Break it down. Did you break something down for us? We told you to take it apart, break it down. We're going to have some folks who shared with us some really interesting things, and you're going to be surprised about the most common object that people found to break down. You may be carrying it with you as I speak. All right, I've said enough. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There it is. That sound means that Science Friday Science Club is back in session, here to wind up another unique project. This one is called Break It Down, and the point of the project was to find stuff, break it to see what's inside, and let us know what you found.
Breaking apart my mother's old garage door opener, which is already partially broken.
Use your fingers and pry it apart. All right, so okay. We got the circuit board. We
have
some wiring.
Old battery.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, we have a plastic case.
So it's all a module, all in itself. And voila.
There you have it. That's Amy from Plainfield, Illinois, and her son-in-law, two people participating in our Break It Down challenge, taking things apart to try to get a better understanding of how they work. Did you break something down? Tell us about it. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk, or tweet us at SciFry. Joining me now are the founders of the Science Club, Science Friday's Education Manager, Ariel Zitch, and Director, Charles Berquist. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, so Ariel, what the project was, break it down, take it apart.
Absolutely.
Hit it with a sledgehammer.
Get in there any way you can. We wanted, you know, those objects in your life or those things around you that are just too complex to understand up front, right? So that's stuff that you really have to simplify and pull apart and look inside to understand how they work. That was the invitation. So everybody out there who broke something down, I bet you figured out something super cool.
Charles, did you break something down? Do you have a favorite thing that you worked on?
Yeah, I mean, my son and I, we have an old mixer, one of the bread mixer for the kitchen. And we opened it up, and the arrangement of interlocking gears that translate the motion of the motor into the circular going around part of the beater, it's so complicated. I mean, it makes sense when you look at it, but you never really guess how it all fits into that housing together.
Wow, that is fun. And did you? How many participants did we get, Ariel? A lot of reaction on this?
Tons of participation. And actually, people were really into devices. So as Charles implied, right, these simple things that you think, oh, yeah, I totally know how a mixer works, or I absolutely have some idea of what's inside of a telephone. Like, they don't. And when you open it up, you get these beautiful technological wonders that just kind of splay out all over people's dining room tables. Everything, including, and not just devices, including a bunch of other stuff, too.
Yeah, and one of the most surprising things about this project was the number of people who chose to take their pens apart.
Yes, the pen.
Especially my retractable ball pen. Yeah, it's kind of springy and clicky thing. So joining me now to walk us through the magic of the clicky pen is Will Link. He's an engineer and product manager in the stationery division of BIC. BIC Pen. You know, BIC International, you probably have one of their pens, like this one right near you. He joins me by phone from South Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Hey, guys.
Hey, tell us, you know, how, when you take it apart, there's so many little parts in it there. The spring, for example, that comes out first. Are they the same springs in every kind of pen?
No. For BIC pens, we make many, many different springs depending on the requirement of the pen. It goes from the length to the force needed to retract the mechanism or retract the point back into the pen.
Mm-hmm. And what is the most important part? Everybody, take your pens apart. Take your BIC pen apart if you got one.
Yeah, if you've got a pen at home, go for it. That's what we're all about here. So start taking your pen apart.
What is the most important part of the pen?
I don't want to shortchange any of my colleagues at BIC, but one of the more important components is the ball that's in the point. It's a sphere that's made of tungsten carbide, very hard and dense material.
So this is right at the very tip of the point, not the not the sort of cone shape, but a tiny little sphere right in the tip.
Right, you have to look like really close at it.
It's like 1 millimeter in diameter. So
how hard is
very
it?
Very small.
How hard is it to make that point?
Well, Bic has been making pins since 1950, and we're very vertically integrated. We make our own balls, and there's a lot that goes into it. But one of the most important parts is having a very a surface that doesn't have any imperfections. If you have an imperfection, you're going to feel that when you write. Mm-hmm. It's going to be less smooth. It's going to not give you a clean line in a ballpoint pen.
So you have to make it very smooth so that it works. Do you make your own springs? Is it, you know?
Yeah, yes. This is old technology, but it's done on a spring machine, and they're fascinating to watch them make springs.
Now, I have to ask you a question, because we saw all these Bic pens get submitted by our participants. There's this weird little, like, white plastic thing that has a bunch of ridges on it. It's like a circular thing. It's kind of at the top near the part that you actually click. What is that?
So that's part of the mechanism. That allows when you press the button that the pin goes down, you press it again and it retracts back up. So it's sort of like a teeth, acts like a sewing machine if you press it very quickly. So that's it rotates around and it matches with usually one or two other components.
So we all know the people that like just sit there all day and click. How many clicks do you build a pen for? I mean,
that's a good question. So we design our pens. We test, put them through a series of maybe 25, 30 different torture tests, and one of them is 50,000 cycles. So we design for one of our pens to last up to 50,000 cycles.
And is the click something that you're actually going for? I mean, are there people
that want
a silent pen, or is that something that you're building into the pen deliberately?
Well, what we found were when we did not have, when we designed a pen sometimes without that sound, we got some feedback that maybe that's not good, because for a retractable pen, the reason you retract it is so you can put it in your shirt pocket or pocketbook and you don't get ink on anything around it. So we find that end users want that reaffirming click when you press the actuator, press the button.
Thank you. That's been one last question. How can you make a ballpoint pen any better? Is there pen technology research that goes on to make the best one?
Ira, it's unbelievable how much the team puts into pens every year, trying to refine just a little bit better, smoother writing pens. If we go back to our crystal pen that we launched in 1950, it's had many, many advances over the years.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in Electric Drill to show how tough those those points were. Will Link is an engineer and product manager in the stationary division of Bic International. Thank you, Will, for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure, guys.
Let's talk about some other things that people broke down.
All kinds of stuff, all over the spectrum. One person has an old Jeep that they've got in their garage, and they are extensively documenting the nuts and bolts and gears and everything. It's really almost a work of art. There's just the number of pieces laid out all over the place. There were people with DVD players. That was a popular one because you've got all the little lasers and lenses and the motor that turns the thing around.
Lots of obsolete technology, right? So, I mean, this is where you're like, that electronics recyclables container that you've been meaning to go through is like, it's like a treasure trove in there. You get in there and you find got a whole bunch of old phones, so like the handsets for the ones when they were wireless, but you still had the phone hardline into the wall, right? We have, there were some smartphones that were taken apart, including like really cool Peely touchpads. And there also were some things that weren't technological in nature, but I want to go to this one that sounded particularly cool.
That's what we had at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, see if you can tell what this is. Anybody? It's a special sound. You might recognize it around breakfast. That's a toaster. That's that wire cassette that kind of closes up over your toast and sucks it into the hotspot. That is what that sound is. And we had some students take this apart from Legacy School out in Sykesville, Maryland. They did a whole bunch of these things. Here's another really great one.
Can I do it this time here?
Yeah.
It shakes your body.
So, Ira, can you name that sound?
I can, because I know what it is, but it is a sound you will never hardly hear.
That's right.
Today.
And the joy of those young students discovering the magic of the rotary phone dials spinning around with that
fleeting technology.
You never wanted to dial zero because it took forever to come back.
That's right. But, you know, A, they wouldn't have had an experience with that technology, but it's also a way that they can kind of get an insight into the mysterious black box of how more modern things work. You know, if you look at that rotary phone dial and you figure out, oh, there's all these little switches in there and it goes tick, tick, tick maybe my smartphone has some kind of switch equivalent thing going on in there. It's not magic. It's technology.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we lose that a lot, especially, you know, the technology that kids are interacting with now. It's small, right? Everything gets smaller. And those smartphones, there's a motor in there that makes your phone vibrate. But finding the motor in a smartphone versus finding a motor in, like, an old giant killer phone, I mean, that's something. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about what people have submitted. I know that we
go
have some,
for it.
Yeah, some folks calling in.
Kathleen in Oregon, who sent us something she did.
Hi. Hello.
Hi there. Hi, Kathleen. Hi. What you did this with your son, Wyatt, is that right?
Yes, I did. Yeah, he's 2 years old, and we decided to take apart a VTEC car.
What's a VTEC car?
So a VTEC car is a toy that little kids play with, and there's a track. It's called a smart track, and it has bumps on the track so that when the car drives over these certain bumps, the car makes different noises.
So you took it apart with your son?
Yes, yeah.
Did you find anything surprising in there?
Yeah, I found a circuit board in there, which I hadn't really formed a thought of what I might find in there beforehand. But I also figured out why it was making those sounds as it was driving over that track. So there's teeth on the bottom that get pushed up into the car when it drives over the different bumps that are there along the road. And so when we took it apart, I could see that there were these little metal strips that were bent at like a 45-degree angle, kind of, underneath the or just above the teeth. So when the teeth were pushing up, then that metal spring almost was making a connection with the circuit board that was in there, and that's how the sound was being created. And I hadn't really thought about how it was getting there. And
you got
how it was, yeah,
you
how
broke
it was
it
working.
So. Thank you, Kathleen. That was really interesting. I hope you guys had fun. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Wrapping up our Science Club Break It Down with folks who did break it down, let's go to our next caller, Michael in Los Angeles. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Ira.
You took apart a weather instrument?
Yeah, it's a thermometer and a hygrometer. And this is something that was hanging on my wall. It's got two dials on the front, one for temperature and one for humidity. And so I opened it up, and there are two little coils on the back. These are pretty cool. So the one for the temperature is called a bimetallic strip. It's made of two metals that are fused together into a coil. And when it warms up, one of the metals expands more quickly than the other, causing the coil to change shape. And that turns the dial on the front, which tells you the temperature. And like if you have a thermostat or a meat thermometer, it might have one of these bimetallic strips in it.
Right. I know what you're talking about. Thank you, Michael. That was a learning experience. Let's go to Claudia in Atlanta. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Science Club.
Hey.
Tell us about what you did.
So I am a facilitator at a homeschool co-op class. And so as a group, we participated in the project, and kids just brought various things from around their house. The big hit was a DVD player as well as a laptop and computer monitor. So that those were the things I think that they found most interesting to break down.
So How was that, doing it with a whole bunch of kids? Was there a lot of destruction and mayhem involved here?
Yeah, they were super into the whole, like, destruction and mayhem aspect of it. So, but yeah, it, you know, their homeschool kids tend to be pretty independent usually, so I just kind of supervised and gave them some tools and let them go, and we did not have any injuries or anything, thank goodness. Yeah, it was great. They were really, really into it. We spent the whole 2 hours of our class on it, and they were not ready to finish, but it was time to go. So.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for calling us. Let's see if I can get one quick call in before we have to go. Josh in Berkeley. Hi, Josh.
Oh, hi. I'm a composing and performing musician, and I disassembled the Fugue Number 2 of Bach in C minor from the Well-Tempered Clavier, and put it back together using steps that I derived from my analysis of it to try to create a fugue of similar quality and purport.
Whoa, that is incredibly cool.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a big mechanical thing.
Actually, yeah, if you think of music as having all the coordinates of some of the other machines you're talking about, there's a time, there's melody, harmony, rhythm, and form, and those are all quantifiable. We often think of the procedure of composers as being subject to inspiration, but in fact, there's quite a lot of rational thinking that goes along in it, even if it's only at the development stage, and which eventually may subside into, you know, inspiration eventually, where you can do it instinctually. But as a student of music, you're constantly taking apart things. That I play jazz as well, and I'm constantly analyzing solos of Charlie Parker and Bill Evans.
Oh, man, that's so neat.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that one as well. It was very successful. Looked like you had a great project.
I would say so. And to, like, Charles' point, like, not just things, right? Anything. Molecules, plants. We had a gall dissection. We had someone who did a silica gel chromatography experiment as part of their work as a scientist, right? Breaking things down is a great way to figure out what's going on in the universe.
And you may not need to have Band-Aids when you're done.
Right. Band-Aids are optional.
Yeah, so don't stop. You know, you can keep doing this. We're done with this project, but you can keep on going, and you can see some of the ones that other people have sent in at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
Thank you, Charles. Charles Berquist, our director, and education manager Ariel Zitch. We'll look forward to the next club.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
And one last thing before we go, speaking of education, calling all teachers, applications for our 2017 Science Friday Educator Collaborative. It's now alive. We'll work with you to develop free classroom resources, educators nationwide. Apply now at sciencefriday.com/educator. Charles is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Lou Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.